Alternative Radio presents Alan Nairn on East Timor, a case of genocide. I'm David Barsamian. Far from the newsrooms and awareness of North America and Europe is East Timor. It's half of an island in the Indonesian archipelago, east of Bali and 400 miles north of Australia. East Timor was a Portuguese colony for 400 years. It became independent in 1975. In that same year, it was invaded by Indonesia, an ally of the United States. A genocidal occupation has ensued. East Timorese resistance against tremendous odds continues, yet the ongoing tragedy barely appears on the media's screen. Alan Nairn is a leading investigative journalist. He has been prominent in the effort to bring attention to the East Timor issue. In 1991, Alan Nairn and his colleague Amy Goodman were caught in a demonstration in East Timor that was brutally attacked by the Indonesian army. Their report on the massacre won the prestigious DuPont Award for Journalism. Alan Nairn spoke in Portland, Oregon on April 1, 1994.
I think if it's fair to say that if you took a poll of the American public today, in excess of 95% would not know that East Timor exists, let alone know that it has been the site of the greatest proportional genocide since the Nazis, let alone know that the government of the United States has directly supported and armed that genocide. But unfortunately, those are the facts. And when people hear about what has happened in Timor, they usually react with shock and amazement and moral outrage. But you can't be outraged about something you've never heard of. You can't be moved to action by something you're not aware of. And that's still the situation of most members of the American public. But those who do hear about it, I've found just in speaking to people, usually do feel moved to action. But occasionally, you'll find someone who'll say, well, you know, what does that have to do with us? I mean, that's terrible. But maybe it's best that we just not get involved. Well, if you're a citizen of the United States, not being involved is not an option available to you. Whether you like it or not, you are already involved via the U.S. government. In many ways, the genocide of the Timorese, in which 200,000 people, one-third of the Timorese population, have been killed since Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975, in many ways that genocide is comparable to that of Pol Pot in Cambodia. There are some differences, though. In the case of the Indonesian genocide of the Timorese, it's a foreign invading army occupying a foreign land and massacring its population. In the case of Indonesia and the Timorese, they're acting in direct defiance of the UN Security Council, which twice called on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. And in the case of Indonesia and the Timorese, the United States is on the side of the invader. The United States is on the side of the country that is carrying on the mass killing. So whether Americans like it or not, they are involved in East Timor through the American government, which serves as the main political and military patron for the Suharto regime in Indonesia, which on a weekly basis ships fresh arms to the Indonesian military, which they turn on the people of East Timor. And also, in a less direct way, but perhaps with a way that's quite relevant for people here in Portland, Americans are also involved through their corporations. I had a chance to visit Nike Town here in downtown Portland. And it was kind of an amazing place. It's kind of a combination corporate museum, sneaker store, where they have these spectacular video sculpture displays to create a dramatic environment for the sale of their sneakers, many of which, if you look at the tabs, are manufactured in Indonesia. These sneakers retail here in the States are anywhere from $65 to $100, $125. When those sneakers are made in Indonesia, mainly by young women who come in from the countryside, those workers make on the order of about a dollar or two. That's not a dollar or two an hour, that's a dollar or two a day. They're prevented from forming unions by the Indonesian army. They live under conditions of severe repression, and they make possible the enormous profit margins brought out by companies like Nike and Reebok and Adidas. I don't know the figures for Mr. Knight, the head of Nike, but I know in the case of Reebok, Mr. Fireman, the chairman, a couple of years ago made in excess of $30 million in 1 year. That was his yearly salary and bonuses and so forth. That payment to him exceeded the wage bill of the entire sneaker-making world workforce in Indonesia. Tens of thousands of workers in that year, all of their wages combined, amounted to less than that paid to firemen of Reebok, which just gives you a sense, an indication of the kinds of enormous profits that are brought out by these corporations. Now, of course, for firemen and Reebok and for the executives at Nike, that's a very sweet deal. But it's the kind of deal you can only really get in a military dictatorship, where you have soldiers roaming the landscape outside the plants, making it impossible for people to form real unions that can drive their wages up. In fact, until 1987, much of sneaker production had been based in South Korea. But at that time, in response to a small democratic opening, which allowed an increase in unionization there, which created upward pressure on wages, Nike and Reebok and Adidas and the others pulled much of their production out of South Korea en masse and moved to Indonesia, where they could find cheaper, more repressed labor. Now, it's this fundamental relationship between the repression of labor and huge corporate profits which has made the Indonesian military regime so attractive a client to the U.S. government. Now, a little later, I'll get into the history of that relationship. But I just want to talk first a little about what it means for people in a place like East Timor, which was invaded by Indonesia in 1975 and is still occupied by Indonesian troops. People there live under what may be the most totalitarian police state existing in the world at this time. On November 12, 1991, I was in East Timor, and that morning attended a mass at the Motael Catholic Church. The Motael is the flagship religious institution of East Timor. It's located right on the harbor in Dili, the capital city of Timor. Dili sits on the northern coast. It's at the foot of mountains on this spectacular bay. And that morning, the Timorese were holding a memorial mass to commemorate the life of Sebastião Gomes. Sebastião was a young man who had been killed 2 weeks before. He was killed when Indonesian troops stormed the Motael in the middle of the night. They stormed the church because there was a group of young people who were hiding inside. They had taken sanctuary there. Now, the reason they had taken sanctuary was they were being hunted by the Indonesian troops. And the troops were hunting them because they had taken the decision that they would try to speak to a delegation sponsored by the United Nations, a foreign delegation that was going to be paying a visit to East Timor. This delegation, composed of UN people and representatives from the Portuguese Parliament, was supposed to assess the human rights and political situation in East Timor and make a recommendation back to the Secretary General. Now, the impending visit of this delegation sent tremendous hope through the Timorese, because they thought that finally, years after the invasion, this would finally lead the UN to take action to back up those Security Council resolutions. Because even though the Security Council had passed these resolutions, they had never moved to enforce them. So the Timorese decided that they were going to try to speak to the delegation, tell them about the conditions they were living under. But the Indonesian army put out word that anyone who spoke to the delegation would be killed. They called meetings neighborhood by neighborhood, village by village. They would have an officer stand up and say, if you speak to the delegation, not only will you be killed, but the members of your family will be killed to the seventh generation. And they also announced that they had already dug the mass graves in which to put the bodies. But in spite of these threats, many Timorese decided that they were going to try to speak to the delegation anyway. So they went ahead and organized. They were drawing up lists of the dead. They were drawing up petitions. They were sewing flags and banners, which they were going to use in demonstrations to be held in front of the delegates. As a consequence, the army went out hunting for people who it suspected were preparing for the delegation, and some of them took refuge in the church. Well, at the last minute, the delegation visit was called off. It never happened. The United States stepped in behind the scenes and brought pressure, and so the delegation was finished. Within hours after the announcement that the delegation visit had been called off, the Indonesian army stormed the Motael church. They stormed it in the middle of the night. This was the night of October 28th. They went in at 2 in the morning. They shot out the windows of the church, went inside, dragged the young people out, and according to eyewitnesses I spoke to, I happened to arrive in Timor just hours after this raid, they took Sebastiao, shot him in the gut at point-blank range, and he bled to death on the steps of the church. Now, that night, as the army was storming the church, someone was able to clamber up to the bell tower and start ringing the church bell. Timor is an agricultural country, and people go to bed very early. Most, even in Dili, the capital, many people are in bed by 9 o'clock, so this was very late. But people heard the bells. They knew something was wrong at the church. So hundreds of people came running to the church, and they congregated outside as the army was storming in. And I think just by their presence there, they probably saved the lives of others. They probably prevented the army from killing more than just Sebastiao. But this raid sent shockwaves through the Timorese population. Now, on the one hand, there was nothing new about the army killing Timorese. They had already done that 200,000 times before. But this raid sent a special message, because after the invasion, the army had set about systematically destroying every Timorese social institution. And they had ended up crushing essentially every institution, with the sole exception of the Catholic Church. The church, because of its international connections politically, it was just not viable to wipe out the entire church. But the army did that with the other institutions. So to this day in Timor, there are no Timorese political parties, unions, newspapers, radio stations, student groups, peasant leagues, etc. They've all been banned, their leaders executed. To the extent that such organizations exist, they exist underground, beyond the scrutiny of the army, with people meeting in secret in small groups and communicating with each other by writing out notes by hand and passing them from one to the other. So when the army stormed the church in the middle of the night, it sent the message, you have nowhere left to hide. Even the church, even if you go there, we will hunt you down and kill you. Now, 2 weeks after the raid on the church, the Timorese decided that they were going to hold a memorial mass for Sebastiao. and the plan was that they would hold the mass at the church, then walk through the center of town about 45 minutes to the Santa Cruz Cemetery on the other side, where they would go in and lay flowers on the grave of Sebastião. Now, even this was a very bold plan, because public assembly and public speech, political speech of any kind, is banned in East Timor. Dili, the capital city, and the towns of the interior are dotted with army torture houses, where you can be hauled away to for infractions of these bans. And there, the soldiers work you over with beatings with iron bars and slicing cheeks open with razor blades, for example, is one of their favorite interrogation tactics. And people live under this regime of daily terror. So even the idea of walking to the cemetery was quite bold. But the Timorese decided that they would go further than that. They would make an open, explicit political statement as well. And so that morning, as the people took communion, they came out of the church, they came out into the seaside road, and the young people reached underneath their shirts and their blouses, and they pulled out banners that they had been hiding underneath, and they unfurled them there in the road. And these banners were like no one had ever seen before in Timor. They openly called on the army to get out. They called for independence for East Timor. They defended the rights of the Timorese. They defended the bishop, the church. There were portraits of Xanana Gusmão, the leader of the Timorese resistance. There were the flags of banned Timorese political parties. There were banners talking about the role of the United States. There was even a banner criticizing by name Colonel Gatot, the Indonesian Army Intelligence Chief, and talking about the 200,000 dead. And it so happened, I saw Gatot himself drive by the church observing this. And as the Timorese took out these banners and unfurled them in the road, it just sent an electric charge through the crowd. I mean, people were already on edge. They knew that they were taking their lives in their hands by doing this. They could see that soldiers were lined up all along the route of march from the church to the cemetery. And they knew what was at stake. It was their lives at stake. But they unfurled these banners, and they started walking through town. And there were more than 1,000 people at the ceremony. And as they made their way toward the cemetery, more and more people joined. They joined from schools and huts and offices along the way. And as they would pass by the troops, some of the younger people would hold up their hands in the V sign, which they say stands for both victory and peace. And they would shout, chant, Viva East Timor, Viva Independence. Again, an act of incredible boldness and defiance. And as we walked through town and continued, I was thinking to myself, my God, how are is the army going to tolerate this? How is the army going to respond? Because it was clear that if the Timorese got away with this, that this would be a historic breakthrough, that this would be a turning point in the internal politics of East Timor, because a basic political and psychological and physical barrier would have been broken. But yet, as the crowd got to the cemetery, we saw there were no soldiers there. They had been lined up all along the route of march, but there were none at the cemetery. As the crowd got to the cemetery, which is hemmed in by high stucco walls, some people went in to lay the flowers on Sebastião's grave. Others remained in the road outside. And people were talking excitedly among themselves. There was this tremendous sense of exhilaration, this feeling that something great had been accomplished. And people realized that even if from that moment they had been able to go home peacefully, that still would have been a historic day in East Timor, that people in the future would look back and remember November 12, 1991, because this was the day that people had been able to walk through Dili in open public defiance of the army, and it had made a statement that like had been never been made before. But then suddenly an old man who was standing next to me pointed and said, "The Gestapo." And we looked up and saw that the army had suddenly appeared. They had sealed off the only exit route. Soldiers had gotten down off of military trucks. They're holding American M16s across their chest. And we saw, looking down the route of march, where the same road where the Timorese had come down, there was a long column of marching Indonesian soldiers, dressed in brown, holding American M16s, marching in formation. There were about 15 abreast, and they came marching down the road, hundreds and hundreds of them, perhaps thousands. I never saw the end of the column. The Timorese were hemmed in by the high cemetery walls and the size of the crowd. They really had nowhere to go. I thought at the time, okay, we'll go out and stand in front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese. The soldiers will see that we're obviously foreign reporters, and they'll be confronted with a choice. They'll have to either kill us, which would create an international incident, or stage a massacre in front of us, which would do the same. So I thought that we could go out there and serve as a shield for the Timorese, that we'd be able to prevent the soldiers from doing anything. So we went out and stood in the middle of the road between the soldiers and the Timorese. The soldiers came marching up in formation. It was a long road they were coming up. The Timorese behind us were kind of gasping and edging back, but they had no line of escape. The soldiers kept getting closer and closer, holding their rifles. And I started to think, oh my God, what's going on here? It doesn't look like they're going to stop. They were issuing no warning to the crowd. They weren't firing warning shots. They weren't telling the people to disperse. They were just silently marching up. The soldiers swept right up to us. They enveloped us. We were about 15 yards in front of the Timorese. The soldiers got about two paces past us. The road that the Timorese were in was about as wide as, say, this side of the audience here. So you imagine this area here just packed in with people densely standing there, and soldiers about as far as I am from, say, the second row. Soldiers got about two paces past us, and suddenly they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once and opened fire on the crowd. And at first, I thought, well, they must be firing blanks, because I just couldn't believe that they were going through with this. But then I saw the people falling, saw the blood flying out into the air, and in an instant, the people were down, the street was covered with bodies, covered with blood, and the soldiers just kept on firing. Rank after rank of the troops pouring in, pouring fire into this densely packed crowd of people. And, you know, we had been talking to these people just minutes before, a crowd of people with opinions, and just in an instant, they were a street full of corpses. Soldiers would leap over those who had fallen, they would aim and shoot people in the back. There are lots of very young people, children in the crowd, little girls in Catholic school uniforms, a lot of older people, all just torn apart by the bullets. It's indescribable. It's impossible to convey with words what we saw. And seconds after they opened fire on the crowd, the soldiers grabbed us, took away our cameras and the tape recorders because they wanted to make sure that no evidence got out, and began to beat us. They fractured my skull with the butts of their M16s, and they put us down on the ground. And a group of about seven or eight soldiers surrounded us and put the rifles to our heads. And they were screaming at us, "Politique, politique, politics," which is prohibited in East Timor. They were accusing us of the crime of politics for being there to witness this, and were accusing the Timorese of the crime of politics for being there to speak. And it seemed they were deciding whether to execute us. And what we were shouting back at them was, "America, we're from America." Because they had asked before whether we were from Australia. And I said, "No, no, we're not from Australia, from America." I knew that in the course of the invasion and occupation, they had already executed six Australian journalists. So I wanted to make clear we were from the United States, the same country their weapons were from. And in fact, it seemed, you can't know what was going through their heads, but when we convinced them that we were from the United States, that seemed to turn the tide. They seemed to be impressed by that fact. They pulled the rifles away from our heads. I think they may have realized that there might be a political price to pay if they executed us, just as there had been no political price to pay for the Timorese they were executing right in front of us and for the tens and tens of thousands they had executed over the years. We were able to get up, escape from the scene, and later that day report the massacre to the outside world. But the soldiers kept on firing. They sealed off the cemetery, sealed off the cemetery road, went in and slaughtered the wounded. Immediately after, General Tri Sutrisno, the national commander of the Indonesian Armed Forces, gave a formal speech to a military gathering, to graduates of a military academy, in which he said that the Timorese who had gathered in the road were disruptors who must be shot. He said, such people must be shot and we will shoot them. General Sutrisno has since been made the vice president of Indonesia. His was the first of a series of half a dozen statements by top generals in which they made clear that this massacre was an act of state. General Mantiri, for example, who later became the regional commander for East Timor, explained, well, they were protesting against the government. This is why the massacre was justifiable. Now, the State Department, the U.S. State Department, responded to the massacre in one breath by condemning it. I mean, they really had no choice because it had word of this massacre, unlike so many others earlier in Timorese history, had gotten out immediately to the outside world. But in the next breath, saying that they intended to increase U.S. military aid to Indonesia. But it didn't work out that way. Because in response to this massacre, there arose a national grassroots movement, which has become the East Timor Action Network. And ETAN, together with human rights and church groups and peace groups, decided to take on the State Department and the Pentagon and the weapons companies and the Indonesian Army in the U.S. Congress, and you had a battle in 1992 in the Congress on the issue of U.S. military training aid to the government of Indonesia. The question was, would the U.S. continue its what's called IMET, military training aid for Indonesia? On the one side, you had those forces. You had the Pentagon, State Department, Indonesian Army. On the other side, you had human rights, peace groups, this national grassroots network. Also lobbying on behalf of the IMET, you had ATT, General Electric. And what happened was ATT, General Electric, the Pentagon, the State Department, Indonesian military lost. They were defeated because just a few thousand, I mean, this never became a mass media issue in the United States, but some of the thousands of American people who heard about this organized and mobilized themselves and were able to concentrate their calls and letters and telegrams on the key committees and actually succeeded in getting Congress to cut off the military training aid to Indonesia, a historic breakthrough, the first break in the long history of U.S. support for the Suharto dictatorship and the policy of slaughter in East Timor.